just so I keep my man card intact. That's the only episode of that show I've ever seen. That's actually true. Somebody years ago said, hey, you've got to watch this episode. We'll get back to that in just a second. In a series just talking about how we want to remove every non-essential barrier between people and God. Back when we first started the church, that was our desire, to remove every non-essential barrier between people and God. And people often ask, well, what are those non-essential barriers that get in the way? And that episode kind of brings out some of those things. Now, keep in mind, the show, that's not a Christian show, in case you didn't know, Desperate Housewives. It doesn't have a staff of Christian writers. Rather, it has a staff of people, I'm assuming their writers are just everyday people who have an impression of church. And think about the insight that gives you into how they view church, how they view Christians. Just think about what it says about church as a whole. There's non-essential barriers being put up between God and, what's the girl's name, Lynette or whatever her name was? Is that it? Yeah, Lynette. I don't know any of the characters, sorry. True confession. There's non-essential barriers being put up there that the writers of that show have taken notice of. Some of the things you see in there is, you know when you're not welcome. You know when you're being basically told to not come back. And now what you have to understand about TV shows and movies, it's really hard to communicate nonverbal things. So most times in movies, there's just dialogue in there where somebody will come right out and say, go find another church. Typically, I would hope that you wouldn't walk up to somebody and say that. However, there are many signals you can give somebody which makes them feel like they should go find some other church. And maybe you've been church hunting at some point in your life and you've sort of gotten those kind of signals. So that's something that the writer has picked up along the way. Another thing that the writer has picked up along the way that they put in that show is that people pick up on your faith even though they've never talked to you about it before. Notice in there she said, you know, you're the most religious, you're the only religious person I know, you're the only person whose faith seemed real, you're the only person who really seemed to have a relationship with God. And then there's this other piece there where she says, why didn't you ever ask? Why didn't you ever invade my life and my space and come in and be able to sort of guide me in a direction beyond what I already knew? I mean, why didn't you give me some sort of insight into how you would see this through the lens of faith? It's basically the writers are saying, we kind of wonder why it is if you believe so strongly what it is you say you believe, why don't you bring that up at all? Why don't you share that at all with me? And so in there, you just see that the church is putting up these non-essential barriers. There's no reason why she shouldn't be able to come to her friend and say, I want to explore some things. I want to get some questions answered. There's no reason why she shouldn't be able to find a friend who could take her to church and have a positive experience. But that shows reflecting that that doesn't always happen. And it's a sad thing because, you know, one of the things that Jesus set out to do was to change all of that about the way people presented a relationship with him. There was an issue with that back in Jesus' day, and Jesus came to correct it, and it seems like the church has kind of drifted right back into it. I don't know if you know this or not, but everything that happens between the time you pull into the parking lot till here was thought out and intentional. Now, the execution of it may get messed up from time to time because we are all frail and, you know, faulty humans. However, there's a reason why the parking team is pointing you where they're pointing you. Their goal, what they're trying to do, is allow people who this is their first time coming here to be able to park close to the building to make their entrance in much easier. Also trying to give preference for closer parking to people who may be elderly or have a disability or maybe somebody who's got small kids. Some of you are thinking right now, I never got that treatment. Two things. Number one, maybe you didn't because they were providing it to somebody else. Second of all, maybe because they didn't know you had an issue and needed the extra assistance. Just roll down your window and say, hey, can I get a close-up spot? I've got a bunch of kids that I can't really, you know, wrangle up. It's like herding cats, getting them in. Can you help me with that? And they will help you. Which is why for some of you are kind of wondering, I've been coming here for 6 years. How come I don't get a front row spot? It doesn't work that way at church. That's not really what we're here for. We actually are trying to remove non-essential barriers between people and God. So somebody who's their first time here, we want to make it easy for them to get in the building. And then when they get in, we purposely put stuff out front to try to direct them where to go. And that's why there's usually tents and things like that out there sort of funneling you where to go. Isn't it frustrating when you go to a building for the first time and you don't know where to go in? Like if your kids ever sign up for basketball in this city, for any rec league, it is impossible to know which there's one door at that school that's open. There is no marking on it, It is a nondescript door. There are no arrows, no signs, nothing. And you can walk around like an idiot trying every single door, trying to... I learned the hard way, just sit in your car and wait for somebody else to do it. And then you can follow after them so you don't look like an idiot. We don't want somebody to have that experience when they come to church. We also try to do everything we can to provide a safe and secure experience for anybody checking their children into childcare. There's a monitor in the hallway. That way, if they're worried about their kids or how they're adjusting or how they're doing in there, they can go and check on the monitor, the video monitor in the hallway to see how they're doing. There's a reason why we serve comfort and coffee food before you come into church. And the reason is because we want you to feel comfortable. We're trying to remove those sense of anxieties when somebody comes in. Our staff's been, you know, we may build at some point, or we're looking into those options at some point down the road. I don't know. And so we've been looking at different facilities, and it's amazing how many times we'll go to a facility and they're like, oh, we don't allow any food or beverages in our sanctuary. And I'm like, that's not really our philosophy. I really don't really care if you trash the, I mean, I don't want you to trash the building. But what I'm saying is you're always going to be more important than the building, period. It's a whole lot easier to clean a building up than to clean the life up. Right, and that's really what we're here to do. We're here to keep a life in line with Christ and not worry so much about the building. And so we would rather you feel comfortable, because sometimes it's just easier when you got a coffee and a donut in your hand to sort of take in a few things. I don't know, it just makes you feel a little more comfortable, gives you an atmosphere about it. All those things are intentional to try to remove every non-essential barrier between people and God. Because how many of y'all, let me just ask, how many of y'all have been coming to church? Doesn't matter, not this church, it's any church in general. How many of y'all have been coming to a church for longer than 5 years? Yeah. See, what that means is that you have no idea what it's like for somebody coming to church for the first time. You just don't know. It's like, for if you're in the military, it's hard for you to remember what it was like when you first joined the military. That's why when you talk to somebody like me, you start using all this alphabet soup and all these acronyms, just assuming I know everything you're talking about. I don't. Several times I've been invited on base for different functions or events. I don't have any idea where I'm going. I don't know whose parking space is whose, because you all have a big old deal with parking spaces at y'all's place. No wonder you have issues when we don't have that kind of system here at the church. I don't know where to go or what to do. I don't know the procedures. And it's intimidating when you go somewhere, you don't know the procedures. And when somebody comes to church for the first time, most of us in this room have no idea what that's like. No idea what it's like to go somewhere and not know the rituals and the routines and the language and what's accepted or not. That's why every so often somebody will come in here in a three-piece suit and we're all like, oh, first time? Yeah. How'd you know? I don't know. You look nice, though. You look nice. Because you know, we don't know what to expect or what to do there. We want to try to remove every one of those non-essential barriers, because if you think about all the anxiety you have going somewhere new for the first time, now add to that that there is a spiritual battle going on for this person's soul. And Satan desperately does not want them here. He wants them anywhere else in the world other than in this building, where they can come into contact with the God who loves them and gave his life for them. And so you've got all of the normal things plus all that spiritual battle going on behind the scenes, which is why as a church we need to be doing everything we can to remove every non-essential barrier between people and God. And one of the biggest barriers that is out there is this sense of condemnation. Now, this isn't necessarily because the church is preaching condemnation, although there are some churches that's, you know, pretty much what they focus on every single Sunday. But you think about the own voice that you have inside your head that is continually condemning you and beating you down. Think about all of the voices all week long that are condemning somebody and beating them down and telling them they're not good enough, they're not worthy. That's the message that's always shared. We have hundreds of colloquialisms, you know, three strikes and you're out. You better shape up. No, that was Greece. We've got all kinds of just things basically say, you know, three strikes, you're out. What you reap, you will sow. You're on thin ice. All these things basically say, if your performance doesn't match up, you're out of here. And so we just assume it's kind of that way with God. What's hard to understand or accept is this issue of grace. Grace isn't natural. Grace doesn't something that we count on, which is why most people feel like as if they have to clean themselves up before they're allowed to come to church. And that's not just a new thing. That's kind of been an always thing. That's why when Jesus came, he did everything he could to try to change that mindset or that picture about what it means to be the people of God in a community. And so you see he goes through. Like, for instance, even some of the stories, you don't even know that's what the point of it was. Like, when Jesus clears out the temple, oftentimes we focus on the fact that there was a corrupt system going on and that these people were, you know, exchanging money and they were sort of extorting the people for their sacrifices. But when Jesus clears everything out, he says this statement. He says, my house is to be a house of prayer. That's actually a quote from Isaiah, I think it's Isaiah 57, I think. Is that what it is? I looked it up. Yeah, 56, sorry, trust me on it. It's a quote from Isaiah 56. And in Isaiah 56, the whole context of the quote is God wanting people from all nations everywhere to be able to have a relationship with him. And so he says, my house is to be a house of prayer. The full quote is, my house is to be a house of prayer for all nations. Now, that's critical because the area where this stuff was going on was in the temple. There was three kind of distinct areas. One was for Jewish men to come and worship, one was for Jewish women to be able to come and worship, and then there was this other area called the court of the Gentiles, where anybody from the world, anybody from any nation, any language, any culture could come and commune with and worship the Lord God. And what the people who ran the temple decided was, you know, we don't really need to provide space for them because those people really aren't welcome here anyway, so we can use this, we can allocate this space for something else. And that's what frustrated and infuriated Jesus the most, is the fact that they weren't providing any area or room for people who didn't think like them or look like them. And so he goes through and he drives out. He says, my house is to be a house of prayer for all nations. All people need to be able to come in. And in our own context, we need to be doing the very same thing. Think about all the different people that Jesus comes in contact and the relationships that he forms. He's walking down the road one day, and there's this short little guy up in a tree looking down at him. It's a guy named Zacchaeus, and he says to Zacchaeus, Zacchaeus, come down from there. I want to go have dinner at your house. That was an epic thing, okay? To eat at somebody's house shows acceptance. I mean, if you think about the number of people whose houses you've eaten over at, there's some level of acceptance when they invite you into your home, at least, somewhere on some level. And so the very fact that Jesus would go and eat a meal at a guy who, it says he was the chief tax collector. We have a hard time understanding tax collectors in our society, but basically this is somebody who sold out his own countrymen so we could extort them on behalf of the occupying force. That's who he was. He had literally sold out his country. And Jesus says, I want to go eat at house. And the religious leaders look like, what's he doing going to this house? What's he doing hanging out with all these sinful people? Now, Jesus did this so much that he was willing to risk his reputation in order to do it. And if you look at later on when they talk about him, they said, you know, Jesus comes, he's eating and drinking, and here's what they say of him. He is a glutton and a drunkard. He's a friend of tax collectors and sinners. The worst of the worst kind of people who he's hanging out with. And so, I mean, you just assume, well, if he's going to hang out at parties where all that stuff's happening, he's probably joining in there as well. In other words, he was willing to risk his reputation because of that. Now, one of the things that bothers me about church is the general reputation that the church has in the community. And here's what I mean by it. I'm jealous of organizations like AA and Celebrate Recovery, because when somebody goes to Celebrate Recovery, or like if you were to announce to say, if you were to tell people in your office, hey, you know, I've been going to AA now for 6 months, and you know, I'm 5 months sober. There's nobody would go, so? Everybody unanimously is like, wow, that's great. Or if you say, you know, I've been really struggling, a lot of hurts, habits, and hangups, and so I've been going to Celebrate Recovery, whether it be for alcohol or a sex addiction or for PTSD or whatever it may be, you say that, and you say, you know, and I just got my 1 year chip, I'm 1 year clean. There's nobody who would hear that and go, so? Everybody's like, wow, that's great. They love that. Just the very fact that you say that you're either going to AA or to Celebrate Recovery, it's sort of an open admission of, hey, I got some issues I need to work on. And everybody knows that. Everybody has an assumption that if you're going to either one of those two organizations, you've got issues and you're working on them. And we all celebrate that. We all applaud that. However, when somebody hears you go to church, they instantly assume that you think you're perfect. Right? And it shouldn't be. Because it should be, the reason you're going to church is because you got issues. Right? Like, turn to the person next to you and say, you got issues. Some of y'all are like, oh, good, I'm glad I came to Sunday. Now look back and say, so do you. And now look back at them and say, and that's why I'm here. See, wouldn't it be great if when you told somebody you went to church, their first thought was, oh, you got some issues you're working on? Yep. Wouldn't that be awesome? I mean, that was Jesus' picture. That was his vision. That was his hope for church. He wanted the religious people today to get it. He wanted them to say, oh, you're going to Zacchaeus' house? Of course you're going to Zacchaeus' house. He's got issues. Of all the people in the community who need some Jesus, it's Zacchaeus. And if that guy can get saved, it would change our whole community. And sure enough, it does, because he says, you know, if I've cheated anybody else, I'm going to pay him back, you know, multiple times whatever I cheated them out of. It transformed the community when somebody like that comes in relationship with Jesus Christ. Wouldn't it be great if when you told somebody you went to church, they looked at you and said, oh, you got some issues you're working on? You'd be like, yeah, I am. I'm a work in progress. Wouldn't that be amazing? That's what Jesus hoped to establish. But somewhere along the way, we've transformed it to make people think that I go to church and therefore I'm perfect. And if you want to be perfect like me, then clean yourself up, then you can come join me at my perfect holy huddle. That's not at all what Jesus came to do. Think of all the different people Jesus had interactions with. I mean, think of all the different stories. How many times does Jesus have to live out an expression of grace for us to understand that's what Jesus is all about, that's what the church is supposed to be all about? I mean, just go through story after story after story. He says in John chapter 4, I have to go through Samaria. You don't have to go through Samaria. We all go around Samaria. Nobody goes through Samaria. No, I have to go through Samaria. And you realize the reason why is because he knows that there's this woman coming to the well that day around noon that he has to have a conversation with. And so they begin talking, and he begins to share with her about this living water that she could experience where, you know, she could have a loving relationship with God that lasts for all eternity. And then they get on the topic of, well, but, you know, you Jews and us Samaritans, we don't really get along, so, you know, we all disagree on these religious things. And so he addresses that. And then they start talking about the fact that she's been married 5 times, and now she's shacking up with some other guy. And this all goes on. And she ends up realizing that even though he knows everything about her, he still loves her, and he accepts her, and he's just showing her grace after grace after grace after grace. And so she runs back into town, and she goes, hey, I met a guy who knows everything about me, and I think he's the Messiah, and he still loved me and showed me, you know, favor and grace and acceptance, even though he shouldn't have. I wouldn't have thought he would have. It's like changing my whole perspective on who God is. And Jesus is like, yes, that's exactly why I came. That's exactly what I wanted to do. And then you flip over a couple pages in the book of John. The next story you read about is this woman who's caught in adultery, and she gets drug up before Jesus. And everybody in the crowd wants to condemn her, wants Jesus to be the first one to do it, but he doesn't. Matter of fact, what's he do? He says this statement. Maybe you know this part of the story. He says, he who is without the sin, cast the first stone. What's so awesome about that statement is not only does Jesus show her grace in that moment, but he gets everybody else in the crowd to view her through a lens of grace by simply saying, before you look at her sin, look at your own first. And if we would just see other people's sin in light of our own sin, it would change the lens through which we see other people. And the problem is so often we get in church for so long, we forget about our sins. That's how we all become like the older brother in the story of the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15. You got the prodigal son who runs off, and all of us think, oh yeah, I used to be that guy. The reality is if you used to be that guy, then you probably are the other guy, or you're on your way to becoming the other guy. The guy who ultimately doesn't want to come into the Father's house because he thinks he's done everything right, and he's jealous and frustrated whenever all these non-Christian, these non-religious people come into church. And he says, you know, you're drifting towards that place. And what Jesus does in this moment is he gets all the older brother types to drop their stones and begin to see somebody else's sin through the lens of their own sin. There's that woman in Luke chapter 7. Jesus is eating dinner at this religious guy's house, and this woman kind of sneaks into the house, sort of unannounced, uninvited, and she pours perfume all over Jesus' feet and starts washing it with her hair, and this religious leader looks at him and he says, ah, if you were really a man of God, you'd know the kind of woman this was. In other words, you would have shooed her away. You would have gotten rid of her. You wouldn't allow her to touch you. You wouldn't want to be anywhere around her. And Jesus then goes on to tell this whole story about how God loves her, and there is grace provided for her, and because of the grace for her that God has shown for her, and listen, she knows she's a sinner. And she knows how much she sinned, and that's why she's so in love with God, because she realizes just how amazing grace is. And the problem with you is, it's been so long since you experienced amazing grace or thought you needed amazing grace, your passion for God has dropped. And that's the problem once we start going to church for too long, is not that I'm telling you to quit coming to church, I'm just trying to kind of come back and say, you always need to have your sin ever before your eyes. If you ever get to the point where you think you only need a little bit of grace or just some good grace or, yeah, I could use some, whenever it's anything short of amazing grace for you, you're drifting to that place of danger that Jesus warns about and that he was always clashing up against. You're drifting towards that place of somebody who's going to be putting up non-essential barriers that deal with non-grace in somebody's life. There's another story in Luke chapter 5. It's kind of an odd story. It's a story where Peter is out, you know, they're cleaning up their nets, and Jesus says, hey, let's go out, you know, kind of late in the day. I know it's not time you normally go fishing. Let's go out. We're going to catch something. And so they throw their nets over just in obedience to Jesus. And when they pull them back, it's this big miraculous catch of fish. So much fish they can't put in their own boat. They have to get another boat over to share the two boats. And at that moment, Peter drops to his knees. And he recognizes in that moment just who Jesus is, that he is the Son of God standing on his boat. Now, keep in mind, it wasn't just because of a miracle, okay? It sort of was, I don't know. This wasn't the first miracle Peter had seen. Okay, because earlier, like we read, if you read Luke chapter 5, you'll see that sometime like the day before or recently, Jesus had already done a miracle in Peter's life. Peter's mother-in-law was sick, and Jesus came in and he healed her. Now, I don't know what it's saying about how the fact that that didn't really move him, but the fish did, but I'll just let you sort of think about that on your own. But, you know, it's like, mother-in-law? So what? Fish? Oh, wow, you must be the Son of God, right? So what happens in that moment when he recognizes who God is? He says this statement, and it's kind of odd in the midst of it. You got all these fish, you know, flopping around like that. He didn't say, wow, what a great catch. Thanks, man. What he says is, get off my boat. I'm a sinful man. In other words, I don't deserve to be in your presence. I can't be anywhere. You don't want me. You don't want a guy like me. The very fact that you asked me to be one of your followers only shows you just how much you don't know me. And with who you are, you don't want a guy like me. And Jesus reassures him, no, Peter, I do want you. I want you to become a fisher's man. I want you to come and follow me. I want you to leave all this behind and come follow me. And this was an issue with Peter. Later on, if you remember, Peter denies Jesus, and then they have to go have another conversation after another, you know, whole thing around of this. And he gets up on the beach, and Peter's like, no, you don't want me. You don't want me. And Jesus' like, no, I do. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And there's this message you see over and over and over again is this sense of condemnation almost comes naturally, where we almost, you know, have this sense of condemnation over, because all of us, we know our own sin. I sometimes get asked the question, how come you don't preach on sin more? How come you don't, you know, preach on all the list of stuff? And I say, well, we talk about it from time to time. It's just that, I don't know, I kind of have this sense that most people kind of know most of their sin in their life. Like, I don't know, like if somebody's coming in and they're married to somebody and they're sleeping with somebody else, and I come into church and I mention that, I don't think they go, oh. So God does it. He's not in favor of that. Like George Costanza, when he's caught sleeping with the maid and his boss is like, I'm firing you for that. He's like, what? Is that frowned upon around here? Well, I didn't. Had I known, 9 out of 10 times, you know the sin in your life that's a sin, right? You don't need me coming in here and pointing out every single week. Rather, what you don't know and what you don't understand is the concept of grace. I love the way Martin Lloyd-Jones talked about grace. He says this, there's no better test as to whether or not a man is really preaching the New Testament gospel of salvation and grace than this. That somebody might misunderstand it and interpret it to mean that it just means that because you're saved by grace alone, it doesn't matter what you do at all. You can just go on sinning as much as you want because the glory of God's grace will just abound over and over again in your life. In other words, the more you preach grace, people are eventually going to be thinking to themselves, their sin doesn't matter. He says this, if my preaching and presentation of the gospel does not expose it to this kind of misunderstanding, then it's not the true gospel of grace. Grace is so amazing that unless you get to the point where you're almost to the point of thinking you can abuse it, you don't really understand it. It hasn't really been taught thoroughly because we so desperately want to say, but don't do this, but don't do this, but don't do this. And how many times do you see Jesus railing on somebody's sin? Like with Zacchaeus, it never even records what he never like calls him out on it. Like with the woman caught in adultery, you know, he says, where are your accusers? She says, there are none. He says, yeah, now go and leave your life of sin. Like, I don't condemn you either. Just, you know, take advantage of this. Go make better choices. He didn't have to say, well, you know why you got in this situation, don't you, young lady? What are we going to do to keep... I think in that moment, she's pretty convicted. I think in that moment, she doesn't ever want to be there ever again, right? She doesn't really need a lecture at that moment. What she desperately needed was grace, and that's what she received. And over and over and over again, you see Jesus continuing to teach this message of grace. And I remember when I first felt the call to ministry, I was at Florida State. And it'd be a couple of years before I graduated and was able to go on to seminary. And so that very first semester, I decided, well, you know, I've got to take a few humanities. I might as well take some humanities kind of geared towards what I'm thinking about doing in the future. And so the very first class I took after I felt the call to ministry about this was a class on world religions. And it was very informative. I loved taking it. And in that class, I ended up meeting this girl. She was asking me for my notes. And so we got to become friends. And she asked me why I was taking the class or how I signed up for something. I remember sharing with her about my relationship with God, wanting to become a pastor, and I basically shared a gospel presentation with her on that day. Well, that ended up beginning a several-year-long friendship, and I remember about a year into our friendship, she came to me and she says, I don't like the fact that you're always shoving your faith in Jesus in my face all the time. And I said, whoa. I shared my faith with you the very first day we met when you asked me why I was in the class. And you told me that you weren't interested in that, you didn't want anything to do with that, and you were kind of doing your own thing and didn't want to hear about it. I said, from that day, I have not mentioned Jesus to you ever again. I haven't even invited you to church ever again. All I've done was be kind to you and show you love. That's it. You know, I would like go over and fix stuff at her, you know, place that she and her roommates had. I never dated the girl, by the way, in case you are wondering. This was not a dating relationship at all. No, seriously, I never dated the girl. It was just this odd friendship. I don't know, we were just honestly just friends. It was a strictly platonic just friendship. Never held hands, nothing, right? Some of you are like, no, honestly, right? So I remember her response back after I said, no, I haven't done that. She says, you know, now that I think about it, you're right, you haven't. It's just that I know what you believe, and I know the choices I've made and the things that I'm doing don't line up with God, and so I just always feel condemned whenever I'm around you. That's why you don't always need to point out somebody's sin. They're living with it every day. They're living with the consequences every day. I remember another guy I knew, he was coming to my church in Florida, and all kinds of issues going on in his life. And one day we were out working and together on something at the church, and he says to me, he says, hey, I got to ask you a question. Do you know, and he was living with this girl he was married to, he was like, do you know I'm living with her? I'm like, yes. He says, how come you never like called me out on it and told me it was a sin? I looked at him, I said, do you not know that it is? He's like, no, I do. Then what'd you need me for? He's like, well, I don't know. I just always felt like you were going to like come down on me, and I'm always like shocked every single time that you're nice to me. And I said, well, do you know what you ought to be doing? Yeah. Then why don't you do it? And that started a series where he began to make better life choices. But you see, it was the grace and the grace and the grace and the grace that moved to the change, not the condemnation. And that's a hard message for us in the church to know. Because we put up barriers thinking that we're helping when really all we're doing is hindering grace. Grace is the hard message to communicate. Grace is such a hard message that God had to put skin on it and send Jesus to the earth to display it and model it for us. And he says, your mission as a church in this world is to be the hands and feet of Christ. In other words, Jesus isn't here right now except for when somebody comes into this room, when somebody comes into this building, when somebody comes onto this property, they should know what it's like to be in the very presence of Jesus Christ when they're here. They should. And what would that look like? What would that be like? Now, Paul talks about this a little bit, and over in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, he says a statement. He says, I planted the seed. In other words, I first shared the gospel with you all. When I came to this community, came to the city, I shared the gospel. I planted the seed. I planted the seed of the gospel. I'm the one who told you initially about Jesus, his love for you, that no matter what you've done, no matter what you become, God loves you. I shared with you the message of unconditional grace. He says, then Apollos came on as another pastor of your church, and Apollos, we know, was a very scholarly guy, and he says, and Apollos watered it. In other words, he came and he showed you and talked to you about what it means to have a relationship with Jesus Christ and what that looks like and taught you more about the scriptures and sort of reinforced all of that. He says, but God made it grow. What we need to know from that is you and I cannot fix people or change people or bring about a miraculous conversion in somebody's life. We can't do that. Only God can do that. Only God can change somebody's life. And no matter how much you want to, no matter how much you want to manipulate somebody to, only God can do that. Okay? There's a seed that's being planted. There's a seed that gets watered, and oftentimes, you know, that's whether that's you sharing the gospel or me sharing the gospel or you telling them some of the Bible or me telling them some of the Bible, but there's a piece of here that he's talking about to this church. And all through the problem with the Corinthian church is they are a horrible environment for a lost person to be in because it's just so dysfunctional. And what he's trying to communicate to them is it's the church that provides the soil for this growth to happen. And the kind of environment that you're creating, if it's a grace-filled environment, it is the kind of environment where this seed can be planted, where it can be watered, and where God allow it to grow. And our responsibility as a part of the church is to be the grace environment where this kind of seed can grow and flourish. Now, what that means is, some of you all came here from another church. Some of you all developed some bad habits over time. Some of you all have been in church so long, you've developed some bad habits. and you can really mess this up. And if you're going to mess this up, go somewhere else and mess it up, please. Lovingly. Because we're trying to remove every non-essential barrier between people and God. And because we've been working on doing that, what you need to know is in this room are people who are probably nothing like you. There's a lot of people in this room who are nothing like you. A lot of people who are part of this church that are nothing like you. A lot of people attending online who are nothing like you. And what you need to understand is there are Republicans and Democrats and Libertarians all in this room, all a part of our church and watching online, okay? There are people who are rich and there are people who are poor. There are people who are drug addicts. There are people who are alcoholics. There are people who are white collar, blue collar, and green collar. Is Navy still green collar, or do you guys like a subset of blue collar? Are you Navy collar? I don't know what you are. Anyways, there are people who said lightning would strike if they were to come to church, and people who said the roof would fall in if they came to this church, and both have happened. True story. One of them, his wife got saved while he was on deployment. He came back. We were in the midst of doing renovations, and in a room right back there, he literally was back there helping, and the drop ceiling fell on his head. And he's like, I told my wife if I came to church, the ceiling would fall in on me. If God says lightning's going to strike if you come to church, please watch from home, because lightning keeps striking this building, and I love you. I just wish it wouldn't happen anymore. We have people who have tattoos, people who have piercings, people who had plastic surgery, wigs, toupees. Yes, we've seen toupees in here. Don't say anything, just smile and nod. We even have people who wear shoe wedges just to make themselves look taller. We got people with medical conditions and special needs and social anxieties. We've got people with PTSD, anxiety, depression, bipolar. We got people with food order or eating disorders that makes them want to eat too much. We got other people with eating disorders who where they won't eat anything at all. We've got people who are contemplating suicide and people who've lost a family member to suicide. We've got people who trust the police, and we've got other people in this room who are police officers. We have people who believe in flat earth, people who believe in karma, people who believe in evolution, people who believe in horoscopes, and even people who believe in Bigfoot. Alex Goff. Sorry. I just meant Alex Goff goes to the church here. We have people who are porn addicts. We have people who have been in the sex industry. We got people who are transgender, people who are in same-sex relationships. We got people who are hooking up and shacking up and messing up and shooting up all within the past week or so. We got people who had abortions, people who've had divorces, and people who've had affairs. We have people who've been to jail. We've got people who've been in prison. We've got people who know the difference between jail and prison. Some of y'all think it's the same thing. People who've been in them, they know there's a difference. We got people from other countries and people who were from other cultures. We have people who grew up in the Mormon church, people who grew up in the Catholic church, people who grew up in charismatic churches, people who grew up in fundamentalist churches, people who didn't grow up in church at all. And like I said, these are not just general categories of people. When I was crafting this list, I was thinking of somebody who fits in each one of these groups. And all these people go to this church. So the next time you have sort of a conversation or thought in your mind of like an us versus them, or you want to talk about those people, let me remind you, we are a church that is full of them and those. Okay? Let me say that one more time. The next time you think about us versus them, or you want to talk about those people, you are part of a church that is reaching out and sharing the gospel with and is full of them and those, right? And that should change our perspective on who we are as a church, because we're here to be a house of prayer for all nations and all people from everybody. And when they come in, they're wondering, will you accept me as I am? Do I have to conform to who you are in order to be a part of what you're doing here? Or can I just come in and be in an environment, in a soil where the gospel can be planted in my life, where it can be watered over time, where maybe God can grow something up out of this dead soul that I've been living in all this time? Which makes me want to go back to something I shared 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, I shared about lock-in we had a couple years back, not a recent lock-in, but a couple years back. We had a lock-in, and a mother came to me and said, I just want you to, Pastor, very concerned. My daughter came and told me that there were 3 students, at least, I don't know how many, but there was at least 3 students who were at this lock-in, and they were using some foul language, and I don't think this is the kind of environment that we need to be cultivating for as a church. What are you going to do about it? And I don't remember what my exact response is to her. However, if I could have us do over with it, here would be my exact response. And if you ever think this, here would be my response to you. Number one, can we just thank God that they came to church? to a church event. Of all the places these kids could be on a Friday night, that they're going to spend all night around people who are commissioned by God, called and sent to be able to plant the seed of the gospel in their life and water in their life. We want them in an environment with student leaders, like your daughter ought to be, in order to provide the kind of environment where they can come into a relationship with Jesus Christ. Is there any better place that this kid could be? Thank God they're here. You should be praising God when you came home and said, oh my gosh, lost people wanted to be a part of something a church was doing. Thank you, Jesus, that I get to be a part of something so similar to the kind of ministry Jesus Christ had. Second thing, what you should be asking is, in particular, how can we as parents, and you as a parent with your daughter, continue to create the kind of environment where that kid feels accepted? Because I really, really hope your daughter didn't ostracize them. I really hope she didn't make them feel like they've been completely blackballed and pushed out, like as if they're not welcome here. I really hope that when that happens, it would almost be like a beacon for your daughter to go, there's somebody who needs the gospel. There's somebody they need to love on and show acceptance to, because they're probably new here, because they know that most people here don't talk like that, but that's okay. I want to make sure they feel loved and accepted while they're here. And then thirdly, you should be telling your daughter that that's the kind of person they need to be sharing Jesus with. That's the kind of person that when the youth pastor stands up and you know he's going to be sharing a gospel presentation and say, hey, this guy's good. We should listen. Now, Pastor Ryan shared me a little follow-up about that story, because I shared it a couple weeks ago, and he came to me after service and says, hey, of those three kids that were at that event a couple years back, two of those three got saved. They started coming to youth group regularly, and they began a relationship with Jesus Christ that they'll enjoy for all eternity. That's awesome. Now, we just had a lock-in. I don't know if any kids were cussing there. Micah, you got some work to do. Bring in some, oh, if she was, she shouldn't be. She should know better. But no, that's the kind of church I want to be a part of. You know, that's the environment we want to create in youth ministry and ministries we do here as adults. That's what we want to be as a church, a kind of place where somebody can come in and we don't go, oh my gosh, I can't believe they did. We would just go in like, oh my gosh, that's awesome that she's here. Oh my gosh, it's wonderful that he came to church. I'm so glad, because there's a life-changing message here. And I just want to continue to try to create an environment where they feel loved and accepted, such that they will hear the word of God preached, that the gospel can be planted in their soul, that God can water over time, and who knows, maybe, just maybe, God can grow something up out of the ashes of their life and create a new life where there's nothing but dentists in the past. That's my hope, and that's what I'm here to do. That's what we're on mission to do as a church. Would you join with me as we close in prayer? Father, I thank you for your love. I thank you for the grace that you've shown each and every one of us. Father, can we just pause for a moment and come to you and ask you, Father, to search our heart, to think about times where we have not been loving or accepting to somebody, whether it be an environment here at church or where we work, where we didn't make them feel as though church was for everybody, the church was for them, that the gospel was for them. Father, forgive us for the times where we've been quick to show you a judgmental spirit rather than grace. Forgive us for an us versus them or a those people mentality. And Father, may we be a church full of us and those and thems all together, under one roof, under one name, all proclaiming who you are and what you've done in our life. Father, give me the eyes to see the mission that's before us, to thank you for bringing people in my life who are nothing like me or that need desperately to hear your gospel. Father, may I just take on the mantle of leadership to create the environment for them, and look for the time to share the Jesus Christ with them too. And in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.